what's the science behind all this toilet paper buying BS? This was one of the first questions Dr. Carl answered in this Science Hour. In light of growing concerns around the coronavirus, we talked panic buying, human extinction, and washing your hands. We also got to the bottom of one of the most divisive topics. Should you dunk your tea bag? I'm Lucy Smith. Let's do this. You ain't going anywhere because Dr. Carl joins you in the studio now. Carl, how you doing?
Ever so peachy keen. And you?
I'm very well. I'm really excited to get into this episode. And straight up, we're going to start with Kate in the Nullarbor. Kate, what's your question for Dr. Carl?
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
Hello.
I heard that at some point everyone will eventually get the coronavirus. And I was just wondering, is that true?
Okay, let me take you through it. And there's going to be a bit of bad news, but then we'll finish off with some good news, which is that we can fix it. Okay, we've had plagues in the past. So in the 1340s, when the plague came to London, it killed 50% of everybody.
No.
Not just 2%, 50%. Right. So this is a similar thing nowadays, but it's not as bad. So the coronavirus, according to the epidemiologists, they're the medical statisticians, will probably end up infecting between 40 and 70% of all the humans alive in its first pass through the human race, which will take about 18 months. The death rate is on average 2%. So half the humans on Earth, 2%, that means that 1% of all humans will die on average. Now, when I say 2%, it's somewhere between 1% and 10%. It all depends on your genetic background, how healthy you are, how polluted the area is, do you have diabetes, you know, a whole lot of things. But let's just say 2%. So that means that 1 in every 100 people will die on Earth over the next 18 months. Now, on average, we have, this is the bad bit, this is the worst case. It is going to get better and it's the worst possible case. I'm giving you the worst possible case, which won't happen, but this is the worst case. So each of us have about 100 friends and family and acquaintance in our social circle. So over the next 18 months, unless we do something, each of us is going to go to a funeral of somebody who died from the coronavirus. But we can fix it. And this is how we're going to fix it. Now, they're worried about the effects on the economy and they're trying to reduce the interest rates. That's not going to fix it. They're offering thoughts and prayers. That's not going to fix it. Science is going to fix it. Now, if we put in $1 billion and employ all sorts of scientists to fix it, they will come up with two things, a drug and a vaccine. $1 billion right here, right now, and we will save some of that $250 billion loss to the Australian economy. So in Australia, we're going to have a quarter of a million deaths, and each of us, in a worst possible case, will end up going to a funeral of a friend, or it could be us, but you know, it varies with age, and we can fix it by spending money on the vaccine. So each 1,000 people will cost $1 billion dead. So if we put in $1 billion for the virologists and the molecular scientists and the physicists and the mathematicians and the computer scientists and the artists to explain what's going on, and in a disaster like this, you have to be of good cheer and you need to have hard, good information, we will then end up, Australia, developing a vaccine and a drug, and then we can reduce that death rate down from, say, 250,000. If you bring it down to 150,000, we've saved $100 billion. Now, this is a no-brainer for the government because it means if they put in $1 billion, they save $100 billion and it all happens in this election cycle. So they get voted in and we save 100,000 dead people.
Carl, that just took my breath away.
That if we do nothing, you will... It's like the bushfires are coming, right? And if we do nothing, they come and get us. But if we call for help and get firefighters and planes coming from the USA and from everywhere in Australia, we can do something. China built a hospital for 1,000 beds, not in 10 years, in 1 week.
Mm.
If we have a very definite timeline. We've got 18 months. So either do it now or not. Now, one problem is that after the previous pandemics, SARS, they weren't pandemics, but after the previous outbreaks, Ebola, SARS, MERS, etc., the World Health Organization said to every country in the world, you've got to set up a pandemic center. They did set up one in America, but then closed it down over the last couple of years, especially with the current administration. In Australia, we do not have a centralized administration. We do not have a center for disease control like they have in America. What we have is something in Victoria, New South Wales, and Northern Territory, and Tasmania. We do not have a centralized one. We didn't take their advice. Now, this is where the rubber hits the road. If we act quickly, we can save some of those 250,000 deaths, and instead of going to so many funerals, we won't. We just have to spend the money. And the other good thing is that all of those scientists will now stop then working as baristas and taxi drivers, leaving more room for other people to take those jobs, and we'll have jobs and growth.
Dr. Carl Gareth, already quoting you on Twitter, thoughts and prayers isn't going to fix it. Science will fix it. A topical
does
question
now. Does
that
answer the question for Kate?
I think it does. Kate, does that...
Is that a bit too heavy?
Give you a bit of a grim reminder?
It's definitely big eye-opener.
Yeah.
But the thing is, we can do something about it.
Yeah.
We can do something about it. We've already found a bit of the virus which is amenable to a drug. So it gets into our cells by a thing called a spike protein, which changes shape, and people at the University in Queensland have worked out a way to grab onto this spike and stop it changing shape. So you take the drug, it's a protein, it goes through your whole body, the virus enters your body, and then the protein floating through all of your bloodstream jumps onto the virus and grabs onto the spike, and the spike cannot change shape and it cannot get into your cells. Have we developed this drug? No. How do we develop? Throw $1 billion at it and do it really quickly.
Sam in Wagga, you've got a pretty topical question. What do you want to know?
I just want to know, what's the science behind all the toilet paper buying BS?
Ah, this is called panic buying, and I have done similar things myself in the past. So when we had the first oil crisis, when the price of oil was going to go up, I knew that the price of all hydrocarbons would go up, and because I was a very poor hippie, roadie and electronics person, I went out and I bought what was really important, 4 rolls of electrical insulating tape. That was it.
Really?
That was my panic buying.
Were other people getting on that?
No. That was irrational. On another occasion, an optometrist found something weird in my eyeball, and the worst possible case was a cancer that would kill me, but it turned out to be just a little blood vessel. And so I went and got diagnosed, and they said, it's just a blood vessel. And then firstly, I found myself buying flowers for my wife. That makes sense. The second thing was, I suddenly found myself in a hardware store buying a big manly 5-kilogram sledgehammer. Totally irrational.
So why do people do it then?
Irrational. They're irrational.
Yeah.
They're being hit by a threat, and we are not getting advice and guidance. We are not getting direct hard notes. What we need is to set up some sort of TV show that every day gives out a quarter hour update. Dog, you see stuff on the news about the coronavirus and it's just the same things over and over. They give you 15 seconds of the same thing for 15 minutes a day instead of 15 minutes of informative stuff. So if we set up a sort of awareness hotline on some sort of social media or TV, then we will make people feel better, and then we'll reduce this panic buying.
Dini from Wangaratta is saying, so why is everyone buying toilet paper and not food? People are buying food. Perishables are going off the shelves.
Oh, maybe they think that one of the symptoms is that you get diarrhea, so you've got to get lots of toilet paper. Maybe.
Potentially.
What we need is some guidance. This is the time for the government to do the thing called govern.
Travis from Adelaide, what's your question?
Yeah, g'day. Just with all this coronavirus and Ebola a couple of years ago, got me thinking, what actually is the most likely cause of human extinction?
Well, definitely in 5 billion years from now, the Earth will be swallowed by the sun. Right. I don't think the human race will go extinct. Read the book by Freeman Dyson called Disturb the Universe. And I think we will evolve ourselves into, firstly, having space travel, and secondly, evolving ourselves into a cloud of iron vapor, the diameter of a planet weighing 50 kilograms floating through space. They'll be still human because they can talk to us. I don't think the human race will go extinct if we get through these nasty little things like this virus and global warming. We can do it.
Dr. Carl, you may know that at the moment we are in the hottest 100 of the decade, and I had someone actually text in asking if you've got your number one choice for the song for the last 10 years.
Is there any Tay Tay song in there?
I put you... don't you start that, Dr. Carl. This one is eligible, though. It's somebody that I used to know. It's Gautier featuring
Kim Wright. I love this song.
It's a good
one,
isn't
one.
It? You know it.
Yeah, I know this one. This is a beauty.
But you didn't have to cut me out. You know it.
Just keep singing.
No! And Dr. Carl joins you in the studio now, taking your science questions right now. We're going to go to Mudgee and off the coronavirus for a second and into the ocean. Rod, what is your question?
First, I have to say I appreciate Dr. Carl's optimism of the future. My question's not so weighty. I'm just curious, having dived with seals and other marine mammals, how do they stay neutrally buoyant at any depth?
Mm.
They juggle swim bladders where air can be stored, and that's the main mechanism that I know of as a non-marine biologist. So basically they can, like a submarine, take in or dump air, and that way they can float. If there's a marine biologist, please ring in. What's the magic number they should ring into?
1-300-055-36. So we're talking marine mammals staying neutrally buoyant. Abby from the Gong, you've got a sneezing question. What's up?
My sneezing question is every time I have like mint chewing gum or a mint lolly or something, I get the sensation to sneeze, but never enough to actually go through with the sneeze. And I love sneezing, so it just pisses me off.
Oh, no.
When I can't get the sneeze. And I just don't, it only ever happens with mint. And I want to know what the mint does to my sneeze.
Ooh.
There are many things that trigger sneezing, because sneezing is an incredibly important and protective reflex to have. So it's well known, and we've dealt with this before, that about 2% of the population sneeze or feel a tendency to sneeze when they look at a bright light such as sunlight. In an extreme case, each time they go from inside to outside, they'll sneeze, say, 7 times in a row, and it's always 7, it's not 6, it's not 8, right? So in your case, you are one of the people who has another trigger. So other triggers have included thinking of sex, I'm sorry to say, but I'm not sorry to say, thinking of sex and eating a meal, a full meal, and occasionally weird chemicals. And this is the first time I've heard of mint as being the trigger.
Hmm.
So basically, for some unknown reason, there's a bit of cross-wiring and you have accidentally got something that wires this protective reflex into action. I'm sorry you can't sneeze when you love so doing it so much, though.
Yeah. Matt in Tassie, what's your question for Dr. Carl?
G'day, doctors. How are we?
Very good, Dr. Matt. And you're live to air. Lay it on us.
I'm chasing if there's an answer to the evolutionary point of leg shins lacking meat. Like, all the time you run into your shins and there's just nothing to protect the front of your leg.
Mm.
That is correct. So in that space between your knee and your ankle, you've got two bones. You've got the tibia, which at the front has got nothing protecting it, man. And then you've got the fibula, a smaller bone, which is buried in flesh. Why is there so little protective stuff over the front of the tibia, the shin as we call it? I don't know. And what we need is an anatomist to ring in, maybe a comparative anatomist who looks at different animals, with the same structure in different animals. That's such a good question. Look, don't know, Matt, but I'm looking forward to an answer.
And it's just when you hit your shin on a coffee table, Matt, the worst.
It is terribly painful and it just lasts forever. And then if you happen to walk into a tow bar of a car, you can have a scar which stays there forever. So also, if you can give answers, come into my Twitter feed at Dr. Carl, D-O-C-T-O-R-K-A-R-L, and of course the magic number.
Hey, Abby from the Gong, so many people texting in, that happens to me with the mints. Sarah from Hobart, I sneeze every time I have mints.
Oh, so Sarah has it to a higher degree. So she goes to the wanting to sneeze and then carries it all the way through.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
She satisfies the sneeze. Hey, Dr. Carl, I've been seeing so many more alerts about personal hygiene, washing hands, hand sanitizing. Daniel from Launceston, you've got a question about this.
Yeah, so I just wanted to know, at work I've got two stations to dry my hands. I've got the paper towel and I've got the hand with the air dryer. To get the rest of the water off and to get the rest of the germs off, which one will be better and more efficient to get rid of the germs off my hands after washing?
I've spoken to a few infectious diseases officers and they tend to lean towards the paper, because what the soap does is not kill the germs. It solubilizes the germs, the viruses and the bacteria, and makes them let go of your flesh. And then, while they're floating, joined onto a bit of soap and a bit of water, they then get washed away down the sink and away. Bearing in mind that there is no away anywhere on Earth because everything cycles around. But anyway, so if you then have water left on your skin, in that water there's still some viruses. And then if you dry it in their dryer, those viruses will then remain on your skin, whereas if you use paper, you'll take it away. That's part of the price. It's called entropy. To create order, you have to create slightly more disorder, and the disorder is paper. But the good thing about the paper is you can chuck it in your compost and change the potassium-nitrogen ratio and have better compost.
Dr. Carl, I feel as if, you know, we're learning so much about the appropriate way to wash our hands, and I learned that you've got to sing, you've got to wash your hands for 20 seconds, right, under the water?
Oh, bare minimum. I did not learn to wash my hands properly until I was studying surgery, and then it was wash the front of your hand with the back of the other hand and vice versa, and then make a little fist and then wash each finger all the way up and down, and then do it twice. And then you're using about 9 litres of water a minute, and you go in the right order, and then you let the water drain down. The, washing your hands is something we got out of the habit of. Here's a question without notice. When you were a kid, did your parents say, come on, Lucy, you cannot eat until you have washed your hands at the dinner table? Did
always,
they say
that? Yeah.
Right. But we've got out, I've got out of that habit. Have you got out of that habit?
Mm.
Yeah, okay. This is a wake-up. One very good thing we can do besides the, you know, spend $1 billion on developing the drug and the vaccine is personally bring back the habit of hand washing and do it all the time. And I think there are maybe grounds for somebody inventing a cute greeting that it does not involve shaking hands for just while the pandemic is coming through on its first wave.
They've suggested a foot tap, a pat on the back.
You're getting your face next to them. I don't know, an air kiss, but you want to yeah, from about half a metre away or something.
Yes, you are listening to Triple J. It is the mornings and Dr. Carl is in answering your science questions. Before that, we had Glass Animals with Your Love, Deja Vu. Dr. Carl, having a bit of a groove to that one. You liked that one, didn't you?
I don't know why, but there are some bits of music that make me want to just move.
Yeah, make you want to dance. I'll have to video it one day. It's great to see what goes on behind the scenes. But right now, on mic, we are going to go to Eden. Eden, what's your question?
Hi, Dr. Carl. So my question is, why, if you've been on a cruise ship, once you're back on land, you still get sea legs?
You have become acclimatized over a period of time. Seasickness or motion sickness is complex. On one hand, it's due to some simple, as we think, mismatch between what you see with your eyes and what your balance centers are registering. But it's more complicated than that. It also depends on your body position. Now, I've done the experiment with the touching your finger to your nose. Have you done that one? Mm-hmm. Okay, Eden, can you do an experiment for me? You ready for it?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Are you driving in a car? Okay, don't do this experiment.
I just pulled over.
Okay.
I pulled over.
Okay, right. Okay, so shut your eyes.
Yep.
And put your arm straight out to the side and then touch, yep, with your eyes shut, put the index finger on the tip of your nose.
Yep.
Okay, you can open your eyes. Did it land on your nose?
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? So you've got a thing called proprioception, which is even when your eyes are shut, you know where the tips of your fingers are. You know where your body parts are. It's called proprioception. And so with regard to motion sickness, and this is tying in with why you have sea legs for a while, suppose we've got a long, dark, skinny room and you're sitting in the long, dark, skinny room on a chair and I'm dressed in black.
Yep.
And way down at the end there's a light. And I say, Eden, get your hand up, lift up your hand and point your index finger at the light, and you just point your index finger at the light and I come up dressed in black so you don't notice me and I say, hi, and I'm just going to move your arm. And what I do is I grab your arm and I make your finger describe a bit of a sort of clockwise circle around the light and blow me down, your eyes see the light going in. And, no, I'll move your whole arm. I'll move your whole arm so that your finger is describing a circle around the light in a clockwise direction and your eyes and your brain see the light moving in an anti-clockwise circle.
Okay.
Even though it's not moving.
Yes.
So somehow your proprioception, your sense of where your joints are, is why is wired into your brain backwards. So we think that that's what's going on with the sea legs. You got used to continually just rocking and rolling. Without even thinking about it, you just automatically move left and right. And then you have to, it takes a little while to wire that out of your system when you're on dry land again.
Eden, have sea legs affected you?
It has. So while I was on board the ship, I actually don't get seasickness or anything, but I did feel the rocking of the ship.
Yeah.
So, but now I've been on land now for nearly a week. I still, it's only when I'm like stationary, if I'm sitting down or standing still, that's when I can feel it. And it's just like this rock. I feel like, am I actually moving or is it just in my mind if I feel like this rocking sensation. It's just really bizarre and I can't get rid of it.
maybe do a lot of dancing as we did in the break.
And that always happens to me getting out of an elevator as well. I feel kind of buoyant getting out of there. Dr. Carl, I just want to say the nation is currently closing their eyes and touching the tip of their nose. Jono from Pleasant Hills. The grass is always greener, it seems. What's your question?
G'day, guys. First time caller, long time listener.
Yes, Jono.
Just wanting to know, we're down here on the farm and you have the sprinklers on the lawn over summer. You can put heaps and heaps of water out on it. You seem to always get 10 mils of rain and the grass just jumps out and turns completely green.
Mm. And you're wondering why that is?
Sprinklers seem to leave it a bit patchy.
Yeah, so on one hand, the water going onto the roots of the plants, the grass or whatever crop it is you're growing, gets hold of some of the dissolved nitrogen compounds in the soil and makes them more available to the plants. But it does that whether it's a sprinkler or rain coming out of the sky. But rain coming out of the sky has got an extra advantage. It's not picking up the nitrogen. Okay, the air is 20% oxygen. We breathe that in. And it's active for us. The nitrogen is inert. And the nitrogen does not get picked up by the rain and given to the plants. They can't get it. But there are other chemicals in the air. They're called nitrates, or they're called nitrogen particles. It's a weird sort of term, and it's been around for about the last 30 years. And it's changed as our air pollution has changed. And it used to be nitrates, but now it's more ammonia compounds. The point is that in the air are chemicals called particulates of nitrogen, I don't know why, which have got nitrogen in them, which is bioavailable. And the rain catches them and brings them down, whereas the sprinkler does not bring them into the system. So you're getting all that extra stuff. As an example of extra stuff in the air, whenever we've got rain happening for a couple of days, I've got a set of filters on my tanks at home to catch the rainwater. But before it gets to go in the tank, it has to go through a whole bunch of filters. And the last one is a 100 micron filter. That means that in each millimeter, there are 10 little holes. And each day, when the roof has been cleaned after a few days' rain, I'm picking up about an egg, the size of an egg of dirt. And that's just in the air. Right? So there's all this other stuff in the air, including these particles of nitrogen, which are not really particles, and that's what makes your grass greener.
Thanks for your question, Jono.
Wonderful. Thanks, guys. Fingers crossed for more rain.
Yeah. Thank you. And if you are a first-time texter or caller like Jono, get in touch. 0439 757 555. Dr. Carl, we have been chatting the coronavirus this morning, and Ben from Brizzy, you've got a question about this.
Yeah, hey, guys. Just want to get another workplace. Yeah, just wondering, is there any way you can build immunity to the virus? Like, can you do more cardio or eat some certain foods like garlic, any sort of way?
Okay, so looking at a study of 40,000 people who got infected in China, the death rate was 14.5% if you're over 80, 5% if you're over 70, and in the really good group, 20 to 40, it was 0.2%, and the kids don't seem to get infected. And if you've got any other disease, it makes it worse. So the answer is, besides washing your hands all the time, and don't touch your mouth unless you wash your hands first, is, as you suggested, exercise. So now's the time to start living clean. Mm. Don't wake up in the morning feeling, oh my God, I want to die. You want to wake up in the morning with a spring on your feet and a song on your lips. You want to get lots of sleep. You want to do exercise. Eat more vegetables. Remember the words of Frank Zappa, you can't have too much sex or vegetables. So go for the vegetable part at least. So be healthy, exercise, eat well. Cut down on the fast food and if you're wake up in the morning feeling good and do a bit of muscle work, do a bit of weights, move a bit of iron, and that's your best bet.
So we've had a lot of parents texting about the coronavirus this morning, but in particular asking why kids aren't contracting it.
There's a bunch of theories. One is that they're contracting it, but their immune system is better at ignoring it, or they're getting a lower dose, or their lungs have not been damaged by such a long exposure to cigarette smoking or the dirty air. And there's a dozen theories. We're still in the early days. It's only 2 months, but we know that it seems to be real. I know that's a dumb sentence. We know that it seems. Okay, we're fairly confident that it's real. We're not entirely sure why. And this, if we spend $1 billion, will be another clue to developing the drug and the vaccine so we don't end up with 250,000 dead Australians by 18 months, with every one of us having had to go to to a funeral of somebody.
And it is the Science Hour with Dr. Carl. And right now, we're going to go to Rugsy in Canberra. Rugsy, you're about to get a little bit romantic, aren't you?
Oh, a little bit. I mean, it's sort of related to coronavirus. I just wanted to ask a question about kissing.
Mm-hmm.
In my younger days when I was a little bit more promiscuous, I could always... I know, I'm old now. I used to be able to tell when more was going to be happening because of the taste of my partner's when I was kissing. There was a change in the taste there, and I was just wondering if that was just me losing my mind or if it was actually something scientific behind it.
A change in the taste of... Do you mean their saliva?
Yeah.
Okay.
The heat of the mouth and that sort of thing as well.
Dr. Carl.
Well, look, I am admirous of your doing this experiment, but let me ask you the big question, as put forward by the Mythbusters. And here it comes. The difference between screwing around and science is writing it down. Did you write it down? Your success rate versus the taste. Did you keep a record, or was it just mentally in your mind?
Mentally in my mind. I mean, I haven't been that promiscuous, but. I can say with a fair degree of certainty that I definitely found a correlation between the taste and the feel compared to, you know, when someone wasn't interested.
Mm.
As opposed to, I think the vernacular is getting lucky or not getting lucky. Is that still used?
Exactly.
Or is that, well, what's the modern term?
Yes. I don't know. I'm not hip and with it.
Okay, we'll just leave it at that. Look, number one, I think that there's a lot going for what you say, and I do like the way you've kept a bit of a mental tag on it. It would have been better if you'd written it down, but you can't do everything. Number two, I haven't come across any proof of this. If you go looking in the peer-reviewed literature, and if somebody could do that, that'd be just lovely, and give us the answer on @DrCarl on Twitter. The taste of kissing with regard to, how do you call it, getting lucky?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but to me it makes sense, but remember, for every problem there is a solution that sounds intuitively correct, is easy to understand, and is 100% wrong. We could be just fooling ourselves, but it does seem as though you're onto something there, but I haven't got any hard peer-reviewed literature evidence, and you could have been part of that, Bugsy, and you wussed, and you wussed out.
Well, first of all, it's Rugsy.
Rugsy, not Bugsy, sorry.
Rugsy.
It's all right, I had other things on my mind at the time.
I can understand that.
You're going to have to do some more experiments for us.
I'll do my best. I'll take one for the team.
Right now, we're going to go to Mountfield at National Park in Tasmania, where, Andrew, you are on the cusp of a big debate. What's going on?
Yeah, we definitely are. Me and my fiance definitely have this conversation every time we have a cup of tea. We want to know, does dunking your tea bag make the tea more potent?
How many times are you dunking it?
I wouldn't actually know.
Mm.
But she says that she doesn't dunk it at all, and I'm a tea dunker. So we just want to know, what's the go there?
Mm.
Okay, the basic rule in interacting with the universe is that most things happen at the surface. Right? So when you dunk the tea bag in the water and then you take it in, you put it out, you're mixing it up, and you're exposing the tea bag to a lower concentration of the tea-like chemical. I'll just get out of the way now that a tea bag is not a real cup of tea. Mm. It's leaves or nothing. But anyway, getting back to it. So if you just leave the tea bag there, you'll end up with a very high concentration of tea-like chemicals close to the bag. And as you go further away, it drops down. And there's not much of a gradient forcing the chemicals out of the tea bag into the environment. But if you swish it around and drop the average down, then the tea bag surface is exposed to a lower concentration of tea-like chemicals, and so the gradient is higher, and then more tea-like chemicals will come across. Unfortunately, they're fairly thin sort of flavour. I've been trying all sorts of tea bags, so I've been on the road. But you will get more tea-like chemicals if you dunk it and you swish it around, because
okay,
you're doing more interactions with the surface and exposing it. And that's how a fan works. A fan doesn't cool you down. The fan blows away the hot air of your skin and lets some more room air come up against your skin. So it's the surface is where things happen.
So I find that I put the tea back in, pour the water, let it sit for a few minutes, and then I do a bit of a dunkaroo at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. That's
You've never been right. tempted that's to go for the real stuff, man?
Oh, I love tea leaves. No, give me a loose leaf any day.
100%. It's just that we live in our van, so, you know, we're a bit limited at the moment.
Mate, when I did my four-wheel driving and went through 15 of the 17 deserts in Australia, I took my little cappuccino espresso atomic machine with me. I knew what had to be done.
Hey, Andrew, yeah. You're in the van right now. How's it going?
Yeah, it's good. It's just a bit wet down here at the moment. We're finally getting a bit of rain, so we're just deciding on what we want to do today. We might be off to Queenstown. So Queenstown on the other side, on the western side of Tasmania. So we're not sure yet exactly what we're going to do.
Yeah. Well, enjoy your cuppa. Mm. Yeah, have a good one.
Yeah, cheers. Can I just say a quick shout out to Herdy and to Maddie Ousnet, please?
I think you just did.
Yeah, thank you. Ali from Yamba, you've got a question for Dr. Carl to do with evolution and climate change or global warming. Seems like a big one. What's up?
Hey, so my question is, if us humans are causing the planet to heat at a very fast rate, does that mean we're getting in the way of evolution for animals?
Ah, yes, we are. So when I say heating the planet, you're not heating up the core, the iron core, or which is either solid or liquid, or even the mantle. We're just heating up the 5 trillion tonnes of atmosphere at the rate of 400,000 Hiroshima bombs per day, plus the upper levels of the ocean, which is where 93% of the heat goes. And it is affecting the evolution of animals. Consider some animals or insects that are suited for a narrow temperature range of between this and that, and they're living in a moderate altitude halfway up a mountain. Well, as the world atmosphere heats up, they have to move higher up the mountain to be able to maintain that temperature range until finally they can't get any higher. They've run out of mountain. In that case, they begin to die out, or the ones that will survive are different. So we're speeding up the evolution. In some cases, the species are dying out. In some cases, they're evolving into something else. In most cases, they're dying out.
Yeah. And my other part two.
Mm-hmm.
Have humans come to the point where they won't evolve anymore? I know there's technology that will evolve, but as in like appearance of a human?
We're still evolving. We did the evolution for lactose tolerance 7,000 years ago. Blue eyes, blonde hair. We are still evolving all the time. And we will evolve. So, for example, in Europe, the people in Europe have evolved in a way to make them more resistant to the plague. Because the plague came through in the 1300s and killed one-third of everybody, then came through 10 years later and did it again, but fewer people. And gradually, we mutated, we evolved into people who did not have the, here comes a technical term, the CD5R receptor, which is how the plague gets into your body. By the way, a little diversion here. The plague is caused by a bacterium called Yersinia pestis. It's a lovely name, Yersinia. I was going to name our daughter Yersinia, but then my wife thought it would be a bad idea to say, come here, Black Death. Come here, plague, Black Plague, scourge of millions.
But it would be good if she was misbehaving, you know?
You are the Black Death. Anyway, so it turns out that by an accident, the virus that causes AIDS goes in through the same receptor. So the people in Europe have evolved to be resistant to some degree to the plague and, by accident, also resistant to HIV, AIDS. And there are some people in the Scandinavian countries who are so resistant that they have the virus in their bloodstream, but they have no symptoms. At the other extreme, the plague never got to Africa. So then they never evolved to be resistant to it, evolved by the ones being susceptible dying out and a new bunch coming through. And so they're being knocked over by the AIDS virus.
We do have a question here. In that kind of realm, we have been taking questions on the coronavirus. Graham in Melbourne, what do you want to know?
COVID-19, are gloves in any defence against it?
If you are handling a surface or a person who has it on their skin, yes. Otherwise, no big deal. On average, 40 to 70% of all humans will get it by the time this current pandemic has swept around the world in 18 months.
We've gotten a question here from Jay. He can't get on the phone right now, but this one's actually related to news from earlier in the week with Iran and temporarily releasing more than 54,000 prisoners in an effort to combat the spread of the new coronavirus disease in jails. Jay wants to know, is prison a good place to be with coronavirus or worse?
Bad, according to Joachim Rocklov, a professor of epidemiology at Umeå University in Sweden, which wrote an article looking at the people on the cruise ship Diamond Princess. Because they had been quarantined under non-professional, non-medical surroundings, the number of people who got infected was four times more than if they'd been evacuated and properly quarantined.
Goodness.
Yes, so just shoving people together and not giving a medical-grade quarantine is worse.
Dr. Carl, we do also have some follow-up texts about the kissing thing. Someone's saying, Pete from Parramatta, said with the kissing guy, a large proportion of taste is smell, so maybe the pheromones being released during attraction / making out might be giving the different taste.
Our audience is wonderful. I didn't even think of that. You are so right. Thank you for saving my bacon, Dr. Pete.
Dr. Carl, thank you so much for coming through, answering our science questions. We'll be doing it again same time next week, but we can always check it out over on the Triple J podcast. Make sure you subscribe. Fang us a like. We want it.
Right on, sister.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. For more science and to be the first across new episodes, be sure to subscribe. Chuck us a like. Hey, I'll catch you next week.